Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
And there was a guy yesterday, because there's nobody in there, you can actually hear people. They're on the phones and stuff. There was a guy in a cereal aisle yesterday that just snapped. I just heard him snap with his wife. He's like, he's on FaceTime with his wife. He's like, they don't have it, Laura. It's a freaking pandemic. What do you want from me? Now you can see everything I see, Laura. See the empty shelves? It's like a Whole Foods in Havana. They don't have it. They don't have natural bran flakes. You're just going to have to push it out on your own, honey. I'm sorry.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
Alrighty then, from Mason Mitchell in Santa Clara, California, I discovered Adam Ferrara over a decade ago while flipping through Comedy Central and landing on his special Funny as Hell. He instantly became one of my favorite comics, and it brings me extreme joy to know you two are friends. Every time he's on the pod, the woman to whom I'm related by marriage demands I stop sending Adam his material. Last episode was particularly troubling for me because she's convinced I'm the only man who is also required to get all groceries entering our household a stamp of approval via photo text messages. I guess a lot of people actually have to do that
guilty.
Now. Yeah. So thank you to Mason Mitchell from Santa Clara for that. I'm here on one end of my dining room table. Michael is here on the other end of my dining room table. Nigel is at his house. Sean is at his house. We will have Michael Wilbon and Mark Feinsand on the show. I've actually thought about opens and what to do in opens. Before I begin, I just want to give a very, very grateful shout out to Tracy Callahan of Bethesda Florists, who sent over beautiful Mother's Day flowers to the house. This is a very, very tough time for a lot of people and a lot of kinds of work. Flowers. Two of your main days, your three main days, four main days, okay? Christmas, Easter, Valentine's Day, Mother's Day. Two of them were wiped out. Mother's Day and Easter were basically wiped out. Tracy was, I hope he's done well. I know he's still delivering. It's Bethesda Florist if you live in the D.C. area. He's a wonderful man, right, Michael?
What makes you optimistic is it is a local business that remembers. So, for example... My in-laws have sent Liz flowers and houseplants, and you actually can keep these going. So last year's hydrangeas are now in the garden, and they're growing, and they'll bloom this summer.
Yeah, so like, you know, think of all the sorts of people who are hurting. That's one type of person who is hurting, somebody who's involved with flowers. So I've also thought about how to open these shows and whether or not to read emails both at the beginning and the end. And I just think that the connective tissue of the emails is probably pretty good. Plus, I'm extraordinarily selfish, which is why I wanted to get to this one. This is from our new friend, Duska Jensen. She is the senior winery ambassador at Willamette, and I've gotten that right, Willamette Valley Vineyards. And she writes, I was excited to hear you receive my email, a little embarrassed I didn't have all the correct information. You called me out. My boyfriend did tell me about the possible trip to Bandon Dunes. He's a big fan of yours. He's been listening for many years. I enjoy listening to your show upon occasion as well. Keywords upon occasion, which means once every 6 to 7 years. I have a care package. Right? Here's the critical paragraph. I have a care package I'd like to send you now that I've been corrected and know you're not coming to Oregon at this time. Please let me know where to send it, including your date of birth. I hate to ask, however, I have to include it on my shipping invoice in order to remain compliant. It's just ancient. Just write ancient.
I'm so
glad you got my It's Willamette, damn it, reference. We will have to get you out here. It'll be a long road trip, but Oregon is beautiful. Maybe I'll have to come to you. So this is so nice. And I just thought, wow, it can't possibly get any better than that, right? Well, it actually can get better than that. Here is from Dave Spector, who writes, I've been a loyal little for many years now, even managed to convert my wife to your podcast, and she normally despises any sports-related discussions. I was listening to the note you read from Wednesday's pod from the ambassador from Willamette. You're correct, it's Willamette Valley Vineyards. I'd also like to throw my Oregon winery hat in the ring. I'm the owner, winemaker, and tractor driver of Bells Up Winery, a tiny operation located in the heart of the Willamette Valley, Newburgh, Oregon. My wife and I produce a whopping 500 cases of Pinot Noir and several other varieties annually, making us one of the smallest producers in the state, a title we're extremely proud of. We don't sell our wines at stores or restaurants. We've built a wonderful customer base across the country and sell and ship all of our wines directly to consumers. We're as mom and pop and operations you get. No employees. So when you call, email, or come to visit us, you'll always be talking to the people responsible for making the magic in the bottle happen. The theme of our winery is based around the French horn, Alert Chuck Todd, as I played that instrument for 20 years, and each of our wines is named for a piece of music that has wonderful French horn parts. I'd be happy to send you a box of that. featuring my three tiny lot handcrafted Pinot Noirs. That's Dave Spector, Bells Up Winery. So we got Duska Jens.
It's We're time good. For a taste test.
We're good. We're yeah. really, really good. And that's why I thought I'd begin that way. And also with a couple of announcements. Kevin Brown in Seven Valleys, Pennsylvania. Monday is my buddy Glenn's 52nd birthday. You could never understand just how much a birthday shout-out would mean to him. I'm not saying he's standing on a ledge somewhere and you'd be talking him down, but things have been pretty rough for him lately. So we do that. And from Jason Schultz, my wife and I are longtime fans of PTI here in Canada, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, to be exact, which is nowhere near Toronto, but let's say it's a Midwestern city, too. In recent years, she has become a fan of the podcast, too, especially your stories of encounters with parking, wildlife, and now drive-thrus. It would bring me great pleasure to offer as a quarantine anniversary present to my lovely wife, Joanne, of 24 years, today on May 11th, a shout-out from her PTI favorite. So we do that. And the other thing I wanted to mention, later in the show for Old Guy, we're going to do a little Richard tune. We're going to do Long Tall Sally, because Long Tall Sally has a lyric that I think is like top five, top 10. Long Tall Sally, she's built for speed. She's got everything that Uncle John needs. Oh, baby. I need to say this. Little Richard Penniman died over the weekend. So there are people who are very important. Wilbon, who'll be on later. Wilbon always says that black people don't play guitar, that they have nothing to do with guitar, that it's not a black instrument. And I go, really? Really? Because not Little Richard. Little Richard played the piano, of course, with his feet as well as with his hands. But Bo Diddley played guitar, and Chuck Berry played guitar. Chuck Berry, as Bob Seger says, you know, all of his children are out there doing his licks. Get into the mix. And you can come back, baby, rock and roll never forgets. Everybody credits Chuck Berry with rock and roll. Bo Diddley gets credit for rock and roll. Prince is one of the greatest guitar players of all time. Unless I'm missing something, I think they're black. I think. I could be wrong, but I think they are. And this is what I always say to Wilbon, and Wilbon shouts me down. Anyway.
Wilbon and Jimi Hendrix as well.
Jimi Hendrix as well. So I would just say this, that the three people that I want to talk, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley. Bo Diddley did one song. He did it 800 times, but it was one song. And the if you know this from George Thorogood, who plays Bo Diddley songs all the time, you know, Bo Diddley's constant refrain is bump, 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 bump. That's Bo Diddley. Bump, 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 bump. Everybody knows that. That's essential to rock and roll. That is the spine of rock and roll. One more time. Bump, 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 bump. Chuck Berry did three songs. He did Johnny Be Good. He did Sweet Little 16. He did Maybelline. They're all the same. They're all great. Everybody can picture in their mind's eye Chuck Berry doing that duck walk, but it's his guitar. It's his guitar that everyone in rock and roll understands. It's his guitar that the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and, you know, and everybody in the world, it's his guitar, him and Bo Diddley. Okay, that's how it works. Little Richard had three songs. He had Tutti Frutti, Good Golly Miss Molly, Long Tall Sally. They're all the same. He could have had 50 songs. It doesn't matter. Little Richard's got this one thing, a wop, bop, a loo, wop, a lop, bam, boom. That's it. Okay, that's Little Richard. Little Richard's ahead of everybody. There are pictures you can find all over the internet, because people have sent them to me, of Little Richard with the Beatles in, you know, in 1961 or 1962. Mick Jagger said over the weekend, Little Richard's is his idol. Like, everything Little Richard did is what is drove Mick Jagger into rock and roll. All of the movements, all of the ways he sang and delivered songs. You know, that's, it's not a question, for me, it's not a question of Mount Rushmore. I mean, I'm not going to talk who's greater than this one or greater. It's not about that. These people are great. They form the history. You know, if rock and roll is seen as a volcano, they are the lava that got out first. And that's that. They're just that good. All of these people are that good, and the great performers like the Beatles and Elvis Presley and Michael Jackson. These are great performers, as well as in the Beatles' case, great songwriters. Clearly, but that's who they learned it from. Michael, when you were in high school, you were in the singing group. You were in the a cappella group. Did you do any of those sorts of songs, or you didn't do any Little Richard? I mean, that's hard to do an a cappella.
Yeah, no, I just want to pause and say I love hearing you talk about music in this way, because we forget that your first job, you were a
Rock and roll critic.
Yeah, rock and roll critic.
Till I realized I didn't know what
but
I was
doing. But I love when you tell the story of when you first saw Springsteen, because as immediately as you go back to like the to the Bo Diddley, that sound, I'm thinking about all the times you see Springsteen cover that, and then you think about the theatrics of Springsteen and what that stage performance came to be later in the career, and it's just the tentacles of these.
Bruce Springsteen and I are the same age, so we learned this from the same people. Yeah. So we watched all the same people. And in Springsteen, in his Broadway show, which I think is actually available, I think you can watch it on some sort of streaming service, but maybe you can't. Maybe
the Netflix, maybe?
I don't know, because I don't get any of them. But on his show, he talks about when he knew he wanted to be a rock and roll performer. He saw Elvis on TV, and he said, wow, this is exactly what I want to do. But that's performance. The things that are in his soul, the things that came out are, you know, Bo Diddley and Little Richard and Chuck Berry, because they're not the Pied Pipers of rock and roll. I mean, other people took that music and expanded it out, but they're seminal performers in rock and roll. You don't have to know how to even play a note of music just to listen and go, wow, that's pretty much how it starts. So I wasn't going to be able to get to any of that, so I thought I would pretty much say it now. Do you have anything to add? Nigel, you're a music guy. Do you have anything to add?
Well, no, I just think the way you summed it up, I mean, you think of rock and roll as a volcano, and it just sort of exploded onto the scene.
Yeah.
And it's not Bill Haley
in the Comets.
No, it's not Pat Boone.
That's the sanitized version of what rock and roll is. It's really, really different.
See it really reflected as you talked about the guys like Jagger, the guys like the Beatles and Bruce, they worship these guys. And I've seen video of Chuck Berry playing with Bruce and the band, and the joy, the pure joy on everyone's face just magnificent to see.
That's right. You know, it's like you're playing with, you know, somebody who helped invent it. I mean, Bruce Springsteen and the Beatles would never say they invented it.
But it's the invention that you're getting to, which is the sounds that you were sharing. Those are human sounds that didn't really exist. You might be able to pull rock from different threads and different cultures, but to then see what those other artists are able to do with it, that's tracking history.
Yeah. And again, Little Richard, a wop bop a loo wop a lop bam boom. Okay, that's Tutti Frutti. That's not even in Long Tall Sally. That's not even in that. So my great thanks to Dave Spector of Bells Up, is that what it's called? Bells Up Winery, and to Duska Jensen, the senior winery ambassador. Do you think she has that on a jacket where it says Duska and under that one, senior winery ambassador? It's just fantastic. And we are breathlessly
awaiting. What
else do
you do if you're a wine ambassador? Dinners?
I think people have to call you Madam Ambassador. I think they have to do that.
State dinners,
like,
right?
You know, when you walk in and they say, "What is the reservation under?" What is it under? Madam Ambassador. Are you kidding me? All right, we'll take a break. Michael Wilbon will join us when we return. I am Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is the Policy Genius ad. As an insurance marketplace, Policy Genius talks a lot about how unpredictable the future is. That's why insurance exists in the first place. And right now, life is unpredictable and scary. But there are enough brands out there telling you how we're all in this together. Instead, here's Policy Genius's top three unpredictably positive things from April. Thousands of dogs and cats across America have found new homes. Everyone is a baker now, and fresh bread is the best smell ever. People across the world are acting with kindness, compassion, and heroism. Not all of them. Many of them. Now, there's no graceful segue here, but Policy Genius is an insurance marketplace, and there's a big demand for life insurance right now. So if you're looking to get life insurance, here's how they can help. Policy Genius compares quotes from the top life insurance companies in one place. It takes just a few minutes to compare quotes from the top insurers to find your best price. This doesn't just save a lot of legwork. You could save $1,500 or more a year. That's a lot of money by using Policy Genius to compare life insurance policies. Once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and red tape for free. They're in contact with the life insurance companies every day, monitoring developments and helping customers navigate every step. So if you're one of the many people looking to buy life insurance right now, but you're not sure where to start, head to policygenius.com. Policy Genius will find you the best rate and handle the process completely. You can stop worrying about life insurance and get back to baking your own bread, adopting a furry friend, or just being a kind and considerate human.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Andy Branton. Chris in Louisville, who's his pal, submits this. Says Andy is a Louisville-based country blues singer-songwriter, was just about to kick off a tour when every bar and restaurant shut down almost overnight. Unlike Chatter, the shutdown we all saw coming from a mile away. Please give him a listen. If you enjoy his music, support him by going to his website at andybranton.com. Which song is this, Nigel? Is it 47 Minutes Away?
That's right, 47 Minutes Away.
It's very good. Very, very good.
It's terrific.
Very good. Andy Branton. So he plays in Michael Wilbon. Wilbon is in Arizona. I was fortunate enough to get out to play golf yesterday, and everybody who I saw said the same thing. They said, is Wilbon ever coming home? And I said, I'm not sure. And they said, well, Maddie's going to have to go back to school at some point. And I said, yeah, but they got schools in Arizona. This could be it. This could be it. Are you ever coming home?
Yeah, Tony. I don't know when. And I don't know when. What I'm learning, I think, is I never lived here. I spent time here. But could I live here? Yeah. I mean, that's what I've learned, I think. But, you know, there are conditions. I mean, you spend some time somewhere under optimum conditions, you always think you could do it. These obviously are not optimum conditions. And
that's
still,
right. That's right.
Still, I find myself just immensely enjoying being out here relative to, you know, the context that we're living in. So, at some point, but not now, not when you guys have in the 40s and raining sideways on some days in May. No, I'm not interested in that right now.
Has it gotten really hot yet in Arizona?
It's been hot. It was really hot last week. We're supposed to get just an unbelievably perfect Chamber of Commerce week this week, where it's in double digits, and up where I live, which is close, you know, people could say Scottsdale. Yes, all Scottsdale is not the same. Scottsdale is a long strip of land, community. So if you're down in the valley of Scottsdale, Old Town, a lot of people will think of that, then, it's often 10 degrees warmer down there than it is here. So if the high is supposed to be in the mid-90s down there, mid-80s up here, the whole, like, a week to 10 days. So very much looking forward to that. Because you could just be outside. You can be outside in your own home, but you can be outside. So, yeah, Tom, it was a fortunate decision, I think, for us to come and be in Arizona. There's been now, 7 weeks, I think, for me.
It's a long time. Are there any changes? Are any governmental changes, any policy changes? What's happened in Arizona?
It's opening up. And it's not, you know, we're opening up, Tom. We don't have, as you know, you spent enough time here that this is not a place where youngsters flock. You know, basically, when you see people in their 20s, they're visiting their grandparents or their parents.
Right, right.
And, I say that with some bit of exaggeration. But not too much, Tony. So when it opens up, it's not like Georgia or even Florida where people are rushing out. I went to my favorite, you know, Chinese restaurant here in Scottsdale. And as you know, that's Fun Lin back home in Bethesda. But here, there's a similar restaurant that I adore going to, Chinese food. And I was going to pick up, you know, on Saturday night, and I said to the owner, my manager, I said, so when are you guys going to open up? Because things can open up here. In dining in establishments can take place here again tomorrow, Tuesday. And he said it may be a month or two, even though he can't open. And that's what we found finding in a lot of places. A lot of places have been open, but people aren't just flocking outside to go to establishments. Because it's an older community. People are saying, okay, well, let's see what happens. Let me see how we're going to try this on for size. It's a trickle. So just because the policy allows you to open doesn't mean people here have said, all right, fling the doors open. That's not the way this place works.
Yeah, each community each community probably, each place probably does that on their own, which is smart. I mean, the more highly densely populated areas, you would hope that people would lay back a little bit, but who knows? You know, I don't know how it's going to be. Let me get to...
We don't.
Yeah, let's get to the Jordan documentary, because there were a lot of things in the Jordan documentary this time. I had been privately, critical is a wrong word, but I mean, I've been sort of kept at arm's length by the lack of linear quality of it, that it always shifts back and forth in time, and I never know really where I am, and I never know which team Jordan is playing for. But episodes 7 and 8 were, to me, decidedly better, just by miles, than everything that had come before, because it really concentrated on Michael Jordan. There were a few moments in this, in particular, two moments. One at the end of episode 7, where he just said, no, we're going to take a break now. When he was trying to explain and rationalize and justify why he was the way he was. And yeah. he just said, look, that's the way I play. You don't want to play that way, don't play that way. And he took the earpiece out and he said, break.
Winning has a price. Yeah, winning has a price was how tremendous. That soliloquy started. And it was the best. It was the best of Jordan. First of all, it was the best for me, because I talked to Michael enough to know this is why he did it. This is why he said yes. People say, why do you say yes now? Because he wants to attempt to explain to people why he is who he is.
They could have stopped the documentary right there, and I would have been satisfied. Really. You know what I mean? Satisfied.
Yeah. I feel differently about different parts, because there are other things that I, and particularly as a Chicagoan and as someone who grew up a Bulls fan, there are other parts to me. But when he said winning has a price, I picked up a notebook as if I was 30 years old and I was covering him. I picked up a notebook knowing how to talk about it and write about it and talk about it on camera last night. And the funny thing was, when I said that, Scott Van Pelt had done the same thing at the phrasing, the intensity of winning has a price. And basically he said, I have dragged people who don't want to be dragged. I have pushed people, challenged people who don't want to be pushed. And Tony, I have to figure out how to say this, because I don't even know if they'll let the paragraph stay in. I wrote a column which will appear on ESPN.com, The Undefeated. It might be there now for all I know. And in it, I had to go somewhere, which is Jordan holding that baseball bat. And he's pounding the bat into his hand. He's in the locker room, and he's talking about how I have to drive people to winning. And he's got the cigar in his mouth. If Chicago has ever been your home, you have no choice but to think, and I'm saying this carefully and advisedly, you have no choice but to think of Al Capone.
Yeah, I knew you were going there. Yeah,
And particularly Jason Robard's portrayal of Capone in St. Valentine's Day Massacre. You have no choice but to think about it as Jordan chomps on a cigar and has that bat in his hand. And I please forgive me for saying that. And I mentioned it, like I said, they may take it out. They may take that reference out. Because
they're not going to take it out. It's the right reference.
Yeah, but
no, it is.
But there's a certain image, and then Jordan, the way he vanquished B.J. Armstrong and Horace Grant, his former teammates, because they dared to challenge him even in the field of battle.
It is so great. With Jordan,
incredible.
There's a couple of other moments. There's where Jordan begins to laugh at watching Gary Payton say that he could guard him. And Jordan literally just starts laughing and puts the iPad down. And there was an unbelievable, poignant moment where they win the championship for the first time since James Jordan had been killed. Yeah. And Michael Jordan goes on the ground and weeps. Now, people may have seen that before, but it was very, very skillfully done in this.
Yep.
Again, episode 7 and 8. And the baseball stuff is great. Episodes 7 and 8 are so good. Yeah. They're just so good.
Let's go back to Jordan on the weeping. Yeah. We've seen the video of that, because that video was somehow That was allowed. We've seen that video for 20 years. Never heard the sound. Never heard him just sobbing like that. We never heard the sound that accompanied that video. And yeah, I mean, you get the emotion. I mean, it is poignant because you know how close you understand after he talks at length about how close he was to his dad. And
yes.
that just grabs me.
He talks about how he said
dad.
he could face this because his father had always taught him, if you have adversity, turn it into something positive.
Yeah, and you get a picture of James Jordan, and so, you know, there was another time I thought about his mom, and I'm gonna text Michael today. I love his mom. I got to know his mom a little bit because we sat on a flight cross country a couple different times. But the fact that Michael was so close to his parents, and this is something that we don't think about with star athletes usually. I'm going to say this. We certainly don't think about it with black star athletes as often. But you think about how we've seen his parents the last 2 weeks, how his mom said, no, you're going to get on the plane and you're going to take this meeting with Phil Knight and Nike because they got something substantive to say to you. And you get a feeling for Dolores Jordan. And now you get episode 7, a feeling for James Jordan. But more importantly, you get how Jordan felt about them and how close he was to them, to his parents, and however great he was and however he might have gotten on people in practice, you know, and in games and during a season to make them ready. It was essentially a yes, ma'am, yes, sir, relationship he had with his parents, no matter how famous and great he got.
No, it was wonderful. They'd also had, now you and I will divide on this. Scottie Pippen looked terrible when he quit. And then he even looked in the camera and said, I would do it again. And you
he didn't really say it. I know that people thought he doubled down, and you have Michael saying he's not going to be able to outrun this no matter what. It's always going to come up a conversation. And you have Steve Kerr saying he quit on us. It was devastating. But also, Tony, you have Steve Kerr saying,
great in this thing. He's great.
Kerr also said,
Kerr said they loved him.
Not in his character.
Exactly. And that's
why
they forgave him.
How about Cartwright crying in the speech? Tony, let me just say this. Look, people can say, you know, there's so much about Jordan and this team and why are they so different. Tony, a lot of teams have things like playing time they argue over and shots and whose team is it. The Bulls don't have stuff that small. The stuff they had was enormous. The mini dramas are enormous. And so much of it has lasted for so long, and it's relevant, again, because Jordan has said now, here's why I am like I am. And you can take it or you can get out. And when he does, man, you realize there just aren't that many people willing to show that part of themselves, even if the attempt is to make you understand them.
It's really quite good. And by the way, I can listen to B.J. Armstrong forever.
He's great.
I can listen to him.
Now, Tony, I don't know if this comes off. It should come off because B.J., how about when B.J. hits that shot and he goes after him, and looking at it over again, B.J. says, he's Michael Jordan. I know. All I had was a moment.
That's right.
And you have
and then
to
he got killed the next game. Jordan killed him.
But B.J. and Horace Grant, because they knew who they are. You talked about Charles Barkley last week saying, for the first time, understood that.
That's right.
So B.J. and Horace understood they could be the part of a hugely famous team. Starters. B.J. Armstrong, an all-star, voted by fan vote. An all-star. But those guys knew, I'm going to take this moment now. MJ may get me. He may come to get me. In fact, he will get me.
He will.
But I'm taking this moment. And it just, with BJ, I don't know if people understand this. Look who Jordan called when baseball was going to end and he was going to come back. Who he called? BJ Armstrong. And I've long felt that BJ was really his best friend on the team. BJ and Steve Kerr, but BJ, you know, was earlier. And I've always felt those two guys, and particularly BJ was his best friend, BJ Armstrong is a guy. If you're going to get lost somewhere, you have to sit and listen to somebody tell stories or talk about what he does, or be curious about what you do. BJ Armstrong is like on my short list of people to have that with. I've known that about him. I figured you'd like him. I'm glad you do.
I liked it. I mean, I know we spent a lot of time talking about it. It's the only thing that we have live. The ratings have been great. Yeah. And I was, you know, the first six episodes I went in, and the last two.
Really?
Yeah. The last two I've really liked.
We disagree on that, because there's that is a list.
Well, I'm not invested in it. I did't grow up there. I'm not from Chicago.
I mean, I don't think people, I'd say 95% of the people who are watching these huge numbers you mentioned are not from Chicago.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm watching it. I'm watching it because it's out there. I just didn't, you know, I didn't care, but I sat and watched 7 and 8 holding it on a phone, and I just said, wow, you know, those were good. All right, I'll talk to you later. We're going to do PTI again. Right. I'll talk to you later. Michael Wilbon, boys and girls. What do we got? Will Mark Feinsand join us when we return?
That's right.
Am I right on this?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Mark Feinsand?
That's right.
Okay, I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
And this episode of The Tony Kornheiser Show is brought to you by the new podcast, Go and See, hosted by Malcolm Gladwell, who I worked with at The Post. The Washington Post, not the New York Post. We never worked there. Produced by the team behind Revisionist History, Go and See is a six-part series focused on Lexus and the philosophy of Genchi Genbutsu, which means go and see for yourself, an idea that stems from the belief that if you create something yourself, you have a better understanding of people and how to create something for them. In the series, Lexus invites Gladwell to Japan to discover their unconventional thinking and processes firsthand. Find out how a Japanese tea ceremony influenced the engineering of a car window, how the sound of an engine is tuned like a musical composition to elicit certain emotions, how understanding samurai warriors' eyes led to a suspension innovation. Gladwell learns that no detail is left behind and that a car company can learn more about cars by studying people. So go inside Lexus's headquarters in Japan, ride along on a top-secret test track with a master driver, sit in the expertly designed seat that actually lowers to welcome you into the vehicle. Follow Gladwell on his journey wherever you like. All the episodes are out. Go to Lexus.com/curiosity for more stories like these.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Gonna tell Aunt Mary about Uncle John. He claimed he had the music, but he had a lot of fun. Oh, baby.
Little Richard Penniman. Macon, Georgia. Long, tall salad. That's it. Let me repeat that sentence for you in case you didn't hear it. Long, tall Sally, she's built for speed. She got everything that Uncle John needs, old baby. Yeah, little Richard is... Ah, it's just so good. Again, this is not the song. This is not Tutti Frutti. But all of little Richard can be summed up in these words. A wop bop a loo wop a lop bam boom. Mark Feinsand of MajorLeagueBaseball.com, or MLB.com, however it's pronounced and said, joins us. And we're going to talk about baseball. We're going to talk about this latest attempt. The difference between baseball and all other sports is that baseball, on a, you know, almost a daily basis, leaks a new plan to another writer and says, this is how we're going to do it. And then people go, it doesn't sound good. And they say, okay, we'll be back with another plan in 48 hours. But we will get to all of those things. But more important, most important, is that Feinsand wrote an email the other day in which he mentioned Camp Westmont and the Orson Inn. And I went and I said to Michael, did we know that he went there? Because that's Camp Kiyuma in its second iteration became Camp Westmont, owned by some guy named Marv Scooten. Is that the right? Do I have that name right, Mark? Marv Scooten?
You know, he may have been the silent partner. Fred Moskowitz and Jack Pinsky were the owners when I was there.
I don't know those names at all. I don't know those names at all.
Fred, they're both Long Island guys. I think Fred was from Merrick or lived in Merrick, and Jack was somewhere in East Meadow or somewhere around there. And Fred's son Ross now runs the camp, and my kids both go there now.
Is it? It's not called Westmont, though, is it? It's called Independence Lake or something?
Well, so in 1993, a big camp, a Wayne County camp history here. In 1993, Camp Westmont, or sorry, 92, moved across the lake to where the Echo Lark used to be.
Okay.
So Camp Westmont is still existing, but it's on the other side of Lake Independence.
Well, I know that camp well because I went there and wrote a story about that camp in 1980, and my friend Seth Margulies remains my friend to this day from that period of time. So Echo Lark is now Westmont?
Echo Lark is now Westmont, yes.
And what is Kiuma? Independent Lake, right? Something like that? Or
I believe that's correct, yes.
And it's owned by South Africans, and it became a circus camp. A circus camp.
Where yeah, you, I think you know, went through a few different iterations. It was a circus camp. It was a computer camp. It was they've done a bunch of different things over on that side of the lake. But Westmont continues to run as a regular youth summer camp, ages 6 to 16.
Okay, so let's understand how this works. Camp Kiuma was in Orson, Pennsylvania. The across this lake where Camp Echo Lark is, or Camp Westmont now, is in Pointelle, Pennsylvania. These are different places. Small little towns with 30 or 40 or 50 people in them. I have gone through my Camp Kiuma stories a million times. Most important to me is, how did you get there? I mean, how did you get there? Did you get there as a camper? Did you get there as a counselor? Was it an 8-week camp, a 6-week camp, a 2-week camp? How did you get there? And then we're going to talk about the Orson Inn.
It was an 8-week camp. I got there because my stepbrother had gone there the year before. I'm not sure how he got there, but I got there through him. So I started as a camper in 1984. I spent 8 summers as a camper and a waiter on the Kiuma grounds from 84 to 91. And then when they moved across to 92, that was my first year as a counselor, and I did 3 summers as a counselor there, which is where I became intimately familiar with the Orson Inn.
Okay, so a little bit of geography for people who don't care about it, but I will explain this. when you got off Route 17 in Hancock, New York, which is the way if you went from Long Island or New York City, you got to the camp. You got off Route 17 in Hancock, New York, and you got on, I think, 370. That may have been the
correct
route. You got on 370. You crossed into Pennsylvania. You went about 8 or 9 miles, and then you got on 171. You made a right-hand turn onto 171. You went about a half a mile. You made another right-hand turn into a dirt road, and you went into Camp Kiuma, and you did this. You made a right-hand turn onto this road, and on your right-hand side was Doyle's General Store, and across the street was the Medvedev Dairy Farm, which was the cows there, of course. The James Watson, the flying vet, didn't have to fly there. He just had to walk there to take care of those cows. If you had made a left-hand turn and not made a right-hand turn past Doyle's General Store, which may not have existed, Mark, when you were there, it may not have. If you made a left-hand turn a little bit up on a hill, about 300 feet from that intersection, was something called Eddie's. Eddie's was a bar and a restaurant and even a rooming house of sorts, though God knows why anybody would have stayed there. I am unfamiliar completely with the Orson Inn. It did not exist when I left there, and the last time I was there was 1970, before you were born. That was the last time I was there. Did Eddie's become the Orson Inn, or is the Orson Inn another place entirely?
The Orson Inn was on 370. So if you had just stayed on 370 and gone past what was then Camp Echo Lark,
right,
which is now Westmont, about 2 miles past the camp, you'd make a left. And the Orson Inn was right there. And that was the establishment of choice for counselors at Camp Westmont from the time I was a camper all the way through the time I was a counselor.
And what did you get? Was it a pizza joint? Was it one of those places where they had the Slim Jims and the eggs that were in formaldehyde for 10 and 20 years that people dared each other to eat, like me? Yeah, was it like that?
It was. They had rooms up on the second floor that you could stay in, which was
so this has to be Eddie's.
Also,
this is okay. So this is that place that I'm talking about. Eddie's and became the Orson.
There was a bar on the ground floor,
right,
and they did make bar pies and you know, hot ham and cheese sandwiches and stuff like that. But that was where counselors went on their nights off. That was our local drinking establishment. When I went back after I was finished as a counselor, and I would go back, you know, in the following summers to visit my friends, we weren't allowed to stay on campus because that's obviously a danger for the kids to have random people staying on camp. So we would stay at the Orson Inn. So it was, you wouldn't stay there alone, but with 2 or 3 other guys, you felt like it was all right.
All right. So that's the place I'm talking about, which is basically a brown brick place that had been there since 1925 or something like that. I'm sure we're thinking about the same thing. When I was at the camp, we drove all the way to Hancock because in those days, Pennsylvania, the legal age for drinking was 21, and in New York it was 18. So we drove to Hancock and had beers or something like that, which is very dangerous to drive home in terrible fog on these one-lane roads, you know, half in the bag. It was not a smart thing to do, I have to admit.
Lots of deer on those roads as well. So it was always a hazard as well. Yeah, the Orson Inn in Pennsylvania, the drinking age in both states was 21 when I was a counselor, but you managed to find your way around those limitations when you had to.
When is the last time you went back to that area?
Well, my kids now attend West.
Okay, so you go up. So you go up there.
Right. We go up there the last weekend in July every year for Parents Weekend, and they do an Alumni Day on Sunday after Visiting Day. So I go up there every year for a weekend, and it's pretty much the highlight of my year.
And do you play? Does the Lake Lorraine Golf Course still exist? The 9-hole Lake Lorraine Golf Course, is that still there?
It does. I haven't played there in a very long time, but we used to go there on our days off once in a while.
Yes,
great. And hit them around. Yeah, it was great. Great little golf course. And of course, when you're 18, you don't know any better, so it worked out just fine.
So that's where you went on days. Because on days off, we went to either Monticello or Binghamton.
Yeah,
so
we did Binghamton or Scranton. We were sort of right in the middle. So, you know, Scranton, by the time that we were there as counselors, you know, they had all the necessities you needed as an 18 or 19 year old, which was a movie theater, a bowling alley, a mall, and a few fast food joints. So, Binghamton and Scranton were the two big day off destinations.
I'm thrilled that this is where you went to camp. I mean, it's just thrilling to me. I had no idea.
Let me tell you, right now, the question of whether summer camps are going to open this summer is probably the hottest topic in my house and the house of every family that sends their kids to sleepaway camp, because, you know, obviously right now that's a huge question mark. And, you know, I love the fact my kids have embraced Westmont and love the camp experience as much as I did. And we're all keeping our fingers crossed that they figure something out for this summer.
I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. Which do you think is going to open? Which is more realistic to think about, a summer camp or baseball by July 1st?
By July 1st, I would say baseball is more likely than summer camp, only because summer camps have already pushed their potential opening dates a little later than that, but I think there's hope for both.
Yeah, so tell me about baseball, because as I said, now it's down to 80 games. Now it's down to three geographic time zone circumstances. Now it's the latest plan. You play a whole series. You play all the games, six games against one team. I think the players are screaming about money. I don't know how it works. What are your thoughts as to what kind of baseball we'll see if we see it?
Well, I think it's going to be some sort of amended schedule, obviously, in terms of number of games and the opponents. Like you said, it could be a situation where you play, I think the latest thing that's out there is four series against your division teams and two series each against the teams from the other leagues' divisions. So like the Nationals would play all the NL East teams four times, and then they would play the AL East teams twice each, presumably once at each home ballpark. You know, for about 80 games, they've heard 78 to 82, somewhere in that range. Obviously, the big question is going to be, can they do it? You know, is it going to be cleared by the states? Is it going to be cleared by the health departments? Is it going to be, you know, is the testing going to be available to make this happen? What happens if somebody tests positive? There's a lot of things that are going to have to go into this before we even get to the fact that then Major League Baseball and the Players Association are going to have to sort out the financial side of it, because if there are no fans in the stands, you know, the teams have given guaranteed contracts to these players, but that's under the presumption that there's normal revenue streams. And, you know, most teams, I think the estimate I saw was about 30 to 40% of their revenue comes from tickets and concessions and parking and everything else. So, you know, if there's no fans in the stands, I don't see how the owners can open their stadiums to the players, have games, pay them, you know, prorated on their full salaries and not lose a ton of money.
Do you think, I mean, Adam Silver shut down all of sports in America. There was no step in between playing and not playing at all. Do you think that baseball will have steps in between that accommodate positive tests by some people, and they won't shut down the entire thing if that happens? Or is that the model we will see in baseball as well, Mark?
Well, I think there's going to have to be a plan in place. Of course, you know, when Adam Silver shut down the NBA and all of sports, when Rudy Gobert tested positive, this was a new thing. There was no way to, there was no testing yet. There was no sort of plan in place. They're going to have to go into this with a plan in place of what happens if somebody tests positive. Do you have to quarantine that entire team? You know, if players are being tested on a daily basis or on every other day basis, maybe they don't have to. But I'm not nearly smart enough to be able to tell you what's going to happen if somebody tests positive and what you know, the realistic expectations are of what would happen at that point.
You don't want to have baseball start and stop. You don't want to have any sport start and stop. You want to have a plan in place that accommodates the ability to finish. It's going to be much easier for hockey and basketball because they have so few games to go. And it leads to this question. I'll get you out of here on this. Whoever is crowned champion this year, if there is a champion, do you think it'll count? You know, you think it'll count in the same way?
I think it will. I mean, you look at other seasons that have been shortened, whether you're talking about the 81 baseball season, nobody questions that the Dodgers won the World Series that year. You know, the Redskins have won in strike years. Those certainly have counted. So, you know, if there's, I would say at least a half a season, which is what it appears they're aiming for. I don't, you know, as long as it's a real playoffs and you're not going to all of a sudden play a single elimination tournament to decide the World Series, you know, as long as the playoffs are a regular sort of format, even if they boosted to 14 teams this year, but that wouldn't, you know, stop it from being best of sevens in the championship or the World Series, I wouldn't think. I think you would look at them as a legitimate champion.
Thank you so much for being on. I'm sorry to have dwelled on Camp Westmont for that length of time, but it made me very happy to do that. Thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
It made me very happy too, Tony. Thank you very much.
Just wonderful. Just wonderful. We'll be back with Email and a Jingle. I am Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Drones working from our homes, don't think I could zoom more. Clones, heads down in our phones, social skills are done for. From his attic still delivers his rants.
Tony does, yes he does.
Like his listeners probably wearing no pants.
No, I have pants on.
Thankfully.
Dow Jones sinking like stones, can't afford that beach house. Loan plans, you gotta scale back tone, there's always the browse about. Podcasting without wearing a pant.
Is it pants? No, it's pants.
Kill that image, cause I just can't.
Wonderful by John Fitzpatrick of Arlington. Makes me very happy.
A true lyricist.
I am actually wearing pants right now and on the PTI show and all the time. We're just about done. Before we get to the mailbag, let me say, I'm not the guy you kill. I'm the guy you buy. Are you so bleeping blind that you can't see that? I sold that Arthur for $80,000 in a 3-year contract. I'm the easiest part of your problem. You're going to kill me? Thanks to our guests today, Michael Wilbon and Mark Feinsand of MLB.com. Thanks to our sponsors as well, Policy Genius and the podcast Go and See, hosted by Malcolm Gladwell. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Radio.com. If you get the show through iTunes, please leave us a review. From Tom Allen in Canton, Georgia.
Can I just say thanks to...
Oh, that's
like
the bagels. Yes, thank
you. Yeah, Bethesda Bagels, Danny and the gang, 4819 Bethesda Avenue, open every single day of the week from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Stop on by and you will love it.
Yes, get some food, take it out, go home and eat it. Tom Allen, Canton, Georgia. I think I now know the answer to the question of what I have missed the most during the quarantine period. I miss hearing you read emails from Mike in Burke, Virginia. I'll know that all is well in the world when Mike goes back to busting the chops of our favorite one percenter. I wish you and all of your listeners good health and extend to you my thanks for keeping the lights on in the audio village that you've nurtured over the past 3 decades. I'd write more, but I'm headed out to get a tattoo before I go bowling when in Rome. And he writes Rome, Georgia, of course. And as if we had this plan from Mike in Burke, Virginia. I do enjoy the camp stories. I went to Camp Abnaki in North Hero, Vermont, on an island in the middle of Lake Champlain, and the counselors would tell us that we could feel free to run away, but only if we were really good at swimming. Our big event was Olympic Day, as many of the counselors came from overseas and teams were identified by the native land of the counselor. I can still remember our glorious triumphs wearing the colors of Ivory Coast, and I can still to this day sing the Ivory Coast folk song that we were taught for the closing ceremony. I've always been curious about what the words meant and a bit fearful that it's really a diatribe about somebody's mother's personal habits, which is very funny. Jamie Julian in Columbia, Maryland, Gene asked what everybody is eating. If social media is any indication, the Littles are having a COVID-19 snackdown of epic proportions. So crank the wolf spider and rack these snacks. Jen Babish has been absolutely destroying pint after pint of peanut butter cup and caramel crunch ice cream. Eric Laundergan's spam and cheddar omelet recipe isn't as good as a battered deep-fried chicken head, but he's trying. Brad Weiss's pathological baking obsession has yielded massive amounts of sourdough bread and bagels. Check that man for candida. Mike from Burke is sipping Bowman Brothers bourbon and is always thinking unkind thoughts. Classic. As for me, I just ate a can of store-brand sliced black olives with my fingers, and I'm chasing them down with gas station wine that even Luke Russert wouldn't drink. And that's what I call a snack down. Rack me, I'm out. From Kenny Ray in Fort Walton Beach, Florida, who emails a lot and makes me happy. My rock bottom moment in the current shelter in place, watching the Hulu in bed with a double martini dry, microwave popcorn, gummy bears, and Charleston chews. I'm not proud. From Derek Lipson, a colonel in the United States Army Special Forces, who's in Abilene, Kansas. Please don't call my mom. She has no clue who you are, and if she did, she probably wouldn't like you anyway. For all you people that asked me to do that. From Chuck Seligman, a wing chaplain in Aviano Air Force Base, I guess, in Italy. Greetings from Italy, where the COVID battle has been tough, but we look forward to Italy easing our quarantine restrictions this week. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed every episode you've done. Like everyone, you've discovered new ways of doing what provides meaning to life. We listen to lots of podcasts in foreign lands, so your show has meant a lot. As an Air Force chaplain, we've been working hard to care for airmen more than anyone thinks possible, and I'm glad to say we're winning the battle. I'm excited to be moving to D.C. this summer. Might be a frying pan into the fryer situation. Keep up the fight, and if possible, can I be considered the official Air Force chaplain, which includes Space Force of the Tony Kornheiser Show? Absolutely. Nathan Smith, University of Florida. I'm a longtime Little and PhD student in epidemiology, which we need, at the University of Florida. As a student who actually does what everyone in America is suddenly pretending to do, my advice is to listen to Fauci. He's good. I wish somebody who lived in town would take that advice. In our class and workshops, we spend most of our time learning about computer models, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and biostatistical and epidemiological programming. However, in the midst of an actual epidemic, our best public health tools are one for people who are sick to stay away from others. We call this process quarantine. It is approximately 600 years old. And two, for everyone to wash their hands with a substance that kills virus. We call this soap, and it is approximately 4,000 years old. If you see anyone washing their hands improperly, I recommend you come up behind them and abruptly yell, "Use the soap, people!" Thanks for continuing to make the show. It helps. And from Greer Henderson in Chattanooga, Tennessee, just wondering when you will be able to start doing coronavirus diagnoses via the telemedicine clinic in your attic. No rush. I've just had this dry cough ever since my cruise return from the Sea of Japan in March. I want to make sure I don't put anyone at risk when I go to the bars this weekend. In light of your petition for detailed chit-chat about the Littles' quarantine situations, I've decided to acquiesce and write you an email. Since tornadoes swept through North Georgia and East Tennessee last week, we've been without power. There's power restored now, I'm sure. If you'd like to know what it's like to not only be barred from leaving your house, but to also not be able to watch TV, cook dinner, get on the computer or see what you're doing after about 8 p.m. Just imagine any normal time you've lost power for a day or so, but this time you haven't left your house in a month. I had a phone interview this morning in which the interviewer apologized for going past the original time constraints they estimated. I told him, "Listen, I don't care at all. I have no power and I can't leave my house. What else am I supposed to be doing right now? Thank you for doing the podcast. I won't say you're essential because that's a little bit much. But honestly, I do love listening to you and the familiar voices of the show scrape around for something noteworthy to discuss. Don't stress if the content isn't there. We'd listen to you describe the layout of your workspaces until Buster Olney's cows come home." It's really nice. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
Could I say something?
Well, you just did, but go on.
Let it all hang out! With the beautiful Little Richard from down in Macon, Georgia. I am the Bronze Liberace. Shut up!
I've been making my